Welcome to the podcast. Today we have an interesting view on land reform from Russia, Colin Fox on UKIP and the SSP's new pamphlet on the right-wing party, Lewis Akers on pay discrimination, the SNP's Deborah Torrance on an Arbrothian smoky radical party, Jenny Gunn on mental health, and Callum Martin continues a series on lefty history with a piece on the French Revolution. Remember, if you have anything you would like to say about the contributions this week, or would like to record something, or have a band you would like to have played on the podcast, email me at neilwscott@hotmail.com. Today we have music from lefty feminist bands Colour Me Wednesday and The Tuts, Steve White and the Protest Family, Blossoms and The Wakes. We also have news about a brilliant CD launched this week for the Orgreave Truth and Justice campaign. First up, this is Blossom and Cut Me and I'll Bleed.
Ben Irvin, I'm the convener of the Inverclyde branch of the Scottish Socialist Party. A quite concerning aspect of our society just now must be the increasing numbers of homeless people. That's not just a problem in Scotland, it's a problem across Europe. We see it everywhere just now. It's even more absurd that we have these problems when we have the amount of housing lying empty at the moment. On the one hand, we have homeless people, and on the other hand we have peopleless homes. I actually live and work in Russia for part of the year. I'm active with left-wing and socialist groups and organisations over there. they are also experiencing this problem of homelessness while houses and even whole villages lie empty. So what I've asked this week is for a representative of the Just Russia party to give an account of what they're doing to try and address this problem in Russia. Obviously, this sort of international cooperation is something that's important to the Scottish Socialist Party. This exchange of ideas between left-wing groups across the world will obviously help us move forward and strengthen our movements. So here he is. His name's Alexei Gavrilov.
Hello, my name is Alexei Gavrilov, and I'm a member of Party Justice Russia and NPM of the Legislative Assembly of the Republic of Karelia, Russia. I would like to tell about the Russian Homestead Act, a bill proposed by the leader of our party, Sergei Mironov. This bill is about a distribution of free land to socially vulnerable citizens and those workers who deserve an award from the state. Our main objective is to help the repopulation of remote and downed villages. Now people are afraid to keep their money in banks, so they can invest their money in land. The bill will make it possible to hand out land plots to certain categories of Russian citizens for building private homes, farming, and commercial agriculture projects. People can use these lands for one of specific purposes and can't sell them. The maximum size of the plots is fixed at 1 hectare. There are 30 different categories, and most of them are distinguished workers like miners and steel foundry workers, people who have worked in Arctic territories, military and police veterans, and teachers, people with state awards, and other distinguished citizens can also reserve land plots under the new bill. We think it is the right thing to do, as the similar programs were already successfully implemented in Siberia historically. We also find it an effective anti-crisis measure.
Orgreave Justice is a double CD benefit album produced in association with Philosophy Football to raise awareness and funds for the Orgreave Truth and Justice campaign. There are 33 tracks across two CDs of the familiar and not so familiar, each track a musical and political treat. Featuring Matt Abbott, Attila the Stockbroker, Banner Theatre, Billy Bragg, The Black Lamps, Blaggers ITA, Blossoms, Cambodia, Chris Evans Collective, Chris TT, Chumbawamba, Steve Druitt, Paul Heaton, The Hurriers, Jethro Platts, Joe Solo, Rob Johnson, John Langford, Louise Distress, The Movement, New Model Army, The Oppressed, Grace Petrie, Pitman Poet, Quiet Loner, Sleaford Mods, TV Smith, Terry and the Dead, The Concerned Citizens, Thief Action, Tony Walsh, Steve White and the Protest Family, and Wild Salmon. A soundtrack to dance and march to. Details of the music on the podcast today can be found on our podcast page, sspcampc.podbean.com. From the Orgreave Justice CD, this is the brilliant Steve White and the Protest Family, and Which Side Are You On?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? The rich preach of austerity, of economic plan. They want to turn the working man against the working man. Which side are you on? 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 Hospitals, selling off the schools, selling what was held in common, taking us for fools. Which side are you on? 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 Don't scab for the bosses, don't listen to their lies. Us poor folk ain't got a chance unless we organise. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
I'm on the side of the unions, on the side of the strikers, the side of the bloggers, the protest songwriters, on the side of the disabled, fighting against Atos, on the side of the worker, not the side of the boss. I'm on the side of the sick, the benefits claimants, the folk who can't make their Wonga repayments, on the side of the kids, on 0 hours contracts, on the side of council workers who had their jobs axed, on the side of uncut, I'm on the side of Occupy. It's rich against poor if you just open your eyes. Some people say a change is gonna come, so ask yourself, which side are you on?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
This week, the Scottish Socialist Party launches its new pamphlet, UKIP, Europe and Immigration, A Socialist Perspective. It's our fourth new pamphlet, following our ones on fuel poverty, on independence, on the Republic. And it's an important pamphlet because it comes ahead of a general election where this issue will be prominent, and UKIP will get enormous coverage, and Farage will be on all the leadership debates. Europe and Immigration are issues in this general election, and therefore it's handy for Scottish Socialist Party members to have a pamphlet at their disposal that they can use to advance the party's point of view in these matters. UKIP have been described as the insurgent party of British politics, so said the New Statesman. Well, we'll see how they go on. Nigel Farage and UKIP like to present themselves as outsiders to the UK political establishment. Quite a claim for the son of a merchant banker, a former Tory and multimillionaire, to be presented as an outsider. Yet, in truth, we must admit that they've had a certain degree of success. The amount of people that you believe, or you meet who believe that UKIP are somehow the new kids in the block going to chase up and shake out the Westminster corruption, is remarkable even in Scotland, and we've seen that with the unfortunate election of a UKIP MEP last year in the European elections. But it's important for Scottish Socialist Party members and activists to recognise what UKIP are, and they're first of all a right-wing breakaway from the Tories, who are fixated on Europe, who like to blame immigrants and workers who come to this country in search of a better life. They blame them for a crisis. It was caused by the bankers, and perhaps the greatest calumny of our time. Here's holding people not responsible for crime. In fact, in many ways, it's victims of the financial crisis across the world in 2008. They've been held responsible, but the real culprits are allowed to get away scot-free. And of course, the Scottish Socialist Party stands in that honourable tradition of working people travelling the world, making that brave an honourable decision to uproot themselves and often travel thousands of miles to the other part of the world for a better life for them and their families. And we Scots know all too readily, from the Highland clearances right through to the industrial clearances of the 1980s and 90s, where our families are scattered to Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada, throughout Europe and the world, where Scots from previous generations have had to emigrate in search of a better life. And therefore, the Scottish Socialist Party rightly welcomes the young Greeks the young Catalans, the young Africans, the young Syrians, the young Afghans, the young Iraqis, people who come to this country in search of a better life, fleeing persecution, they're welcome. My grandfather used to say to me as a boy growing up, Muddle, my God, it must be a hell of a place they've escaped to if they're coming to Motherwell for a better life. So this pamphlet addresses UKIP, confronts its myths, it confronts the issue of what Europe is to blame for, and quite frankly, what the bankers and what Westminster is to blame for. It confronts the disconnection, deceit and corruption at Westminster, and it lays out the socialist perspective, the working class alternative to all this reaction, and why the Scottish Socialist Party is in favour of joining with Syriza, Podemos, our friends in the European left throughout this continent of half a billion people, to reshape and remodel Europe to the advantage and to the benefit of working people, away from the corrupt, odious, profiteering, greedy corporations who do so much to destroy it. So that's the pamphlet that we offer, and this week's National Council of the Scottish Socialist Party will launch it. We'll discuss how we're going to promote it and take the ideas and use all the many socialist ideas within it to promote the party's views on UKIP, Europe and immigration. And I commend the pamphlet to everybody. It's £3.99. You can get it for a fiver if you include postage and packaging. I hope you enjoy it.
These are the Tots, and this is their new single, Do I Have to Look for Love?
Acres, and I'm a 15-year-old West Fifer, and I'm the branch secretary of the local West Fife branch. I'm an avid SSP member, and I'm standing to be a member of Scottish Youth Parliament for the constituency of Dunfermline, and I hope to represent the people of Dunfermline, especially young people, and combat austerity and combat exploitation. One thing that I think needs addressed more by mainstream political parties is pay discrimination. And I'm glad to be in a party that wants to end pay discrimination by making young people's wages the same as their older counterparts and help combat poverty by raising the wage as well. As we can see from recent stats that featured in the latest issue of The Voice, 52% of workers are in poverty. That means the government are subsidising poverty pay and allowing multinationals to exploit Scottish workers, especially young workers. For too long, corporations like Sports Direct and Amazon had a free ride in Scotland and been given the right to exploit Scottish workers. As we know, young people face the brunt of this exploitation, with young workers in Scotland and the rest of the UK being paid as little as £3.79, even less if you're an apprentice, and even less than the pittance that is the minimum wage for those over 21. And my question is, how can you be expected to live off of that? I have friends who have left home and are living in impoverished conditions and don't even have benefits to subsidise their rubbish wages. I'm not in this situation, but if I was, I'd need to work nearly double the amount of time as an older counterpart just to earn the same wage. This needs to end, and it needs to end now. With Votes at 16 being implemented for next year's Scottish Parliament elections, I hope that fellow young people choose a progressive party that put the needs of the young people of Scotland first. I hope they pick the SSP as a left-wing alternative to the same old promises we see from the SNP and New Labour to give young people the rights they deserve. I hope, like me, they vote for the only party that stands up for young working class people, the only party that puts the needs and the rights of young people first, that promotes equality no matter what age, that practices what it preaches. As a member of the SSP, you're a complete equal to all of your adult counterparts. And I'm glad to be in this party. The SSP say no more to poverty pay and say no more to the exploitation of Scottish young Scottish workers. Instead, we say it's time to outlaw poverty pay and end pay discrimination. Instead of the mainstream neoliberals, we demand a £10 an hour living wage and want to introduce pay equality for young people.
This is Colour Me Wednesday on B3 Sweaters.
I'm in that mood again, want everything to be numb. It's dark at 4 p.m, but my pyjamas are, but my pyjamas are.
I love my sadness, get the best of me. Deborah Torrens, an SNP member from the Socialist Republic of Mogae. So, everyone is talking party coalitions with regards to this upcoming general election. What does that actually mean? That two opposing parties can work together for the best interests of the people? What do you mean I'm being naive? That's the whole point of politics, isn't it? During Scotland's independence referendum, I worked with local folk from all sorts of political backgrounds and folk with no political affiliation at all. The Scottish Socialist, Green and National Party all stood together, often in the rain, in my wee village precincts sharing information about independence with the locals. It was inspiring. I learned so much from my new comrades. And although we may differ in certain aspects of geeky political policies, we were there for one job, to spread the word about the benefits of independence. This seems like the principle should be able to transfer over to Westminster and we shouldn't be too worried about coalitions, except that the parties who could be forming these coalitions might not have Scotland's best interests at heart. Now that worries me. Already we have seen evil venture into devolution talks, English votes for English laws, and while I'm not against that in any way at all, it's diversionary in the talks and negotiations of Holyrood's increase of powers. Each big UK party keep upping their promises for us. I'm just waiting on Scottish Labour, to come out and say they supported Scottish independence all this time. Oh, wait, did they do that already? I'm waiting on the Tories telling us that they want to increase power over renewables and not to bother with fracking. Oh, wait, you mean just power over wind turbines in their own land? All right, I'm waiting on the Lib Dems telling us that they support free tuition. Sorry, I couldn't finish saying that without laughing. I'm just waiting. Because the sad reality is, the great socialist movement started by the tenaciousness of working class people, with the grit of Keir Hardie and the fight of Jimmy Reid, has completely changed. This movement is now Scotland's, not just ours. Look at Greece. But thanks to the independence referendum, we can totally seize the essence and never, ever, ever go back in that box. You might hear, a vote for Labour is a vote for the Tories, a vote for the Tories is a vote for Labour, a vote for the Greens is a vote for the Tories, a vote for SNP is a vote for the Tories, a vote for Labour is a vote for SNP, a vote for UKIP is a vote for the Greens. Wait, no one votes UKIP, do they? Ach, they do, don't they? I can't wait for the day that I'm standing there in the polling booth trying to decide on who to elect for our independent parliament. Will SNP still be going strong? Will SSP be a powerhouse? Will the Greens have surged beyond all expectations? Will we have an Arbrothian smoky radical party? It won't matter, because every party will have to fight for the Scottish people. We will have a rainbow parliament. And I think that's a pretty good idea.
This is another track from Steve White and the Protest Family. This is No Pass Aran and E17.
It's No Pass Aran in E17. The EDL came, but they wished they'd never been, cos we took Bell Corner and they didn't pass. You can stick your racist hatred up your ass. Wall from Stowe were made in vain when RMC members would have let them on the train. So it's Chapeau, the Comrade Crow, the guard police escort at Black Horse Road. It's No Pass Aran in E17. The EDL came, but they wished they'd never been, cos we took Bell Corner and they didn't pass. You stick your racist hatred up your ass. Across police lines to the town hall, we found little Tommy and Kevin Carroll, but their mates never made it. We were many, they were few, wet in their knickers in Barnard Avenue. It's No Pass Aran in E17. The EDL came, but they wish they'd never been, cos we took Bell Corner and they didn't pass. Stick your racist hatred up your arse.
They got no platform here, cause we said, no way. The commas had to come and make them go away. They said they'd be back, but they won't say when. If they show their faces round here, well, they'll see us all again. No Passeran in E17. The EDL came, but they wished it never been. Cause we took Bell Corner and they didn't pass. You stick your racist hatred up your ass. You can stick your racist hatred up your ass. You can stick your racist hatred up your ass.
Hi everyone, my name is Jenny Gunn and I'm a proud co-chair of Stirling SSP and a member of the executive committee, so thanks everyone for listening today. I want to talk a bit today about one of the biggest public health challenges facing Scotland, mental illness. According to Scottish Government statistics, it's estimated that around 1 in 3 people will be affected by mental illness in any 1 year. Depression and anxiety disorders are the most common instances of mental health problems. However, conditions such as eating disorders, self-harm, schizophrenia, postnatal depression, bipolar and personality disorders are all presenting an ongoing challenge to health professionals. Now, the Scottish Association for Mental Health has estimated that 1 in 3 GP appointments in this country relates to a mental health issue. Now, whilst things in Scotland have improved, suicide rates have decreased by about 18% in the last decade, the rate of suicide in Scotland continues to be higher than that of most of Western Europe. In addition to this, the suicide rate in Scotland has continued to be above the Western European average, and since 1993 has continued to be that way. Whilst more people are seeking treatment and support, and the stigma surrounding mental health conditions is slowly but surely being chipped away, there is still a huge deal of work to be done in order to really make serious inroads in challenging the prevalence of mental illness and the real damage it can cause on individuals, their families and their quality of life. Not only is mental illness a serious health issue in its own right, but instances of poor mental health and well-being can also have a huge impact upon an individual's physical health and general quality of life. The British Journal of Psychiatry has found that people with severe mental health problems are more likely to die prematurely. The Disability Rights Commission, in the report entitled Equal Treatment, Closing the Gap, found that people with mental health problems are more likely than others to have strokes and coronary heart diseases before the age of 55. Income inequality also has a direct link to instances of mental health. In their book, The Spirit Level, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett have dissected the statistics and found that there are lower levels of mental illness in countries where income equality is low. For example, countries such as Japan have considerably lower rates of mental illness than countries such as the USA, which, by the way, tops all the charts in the Western world, and indeed the UK as a whole. The SAMH own research has discovered that a staggering 79% of people with significant mental health problems are unemployed, either unable to work due to their condition, but more often than not, their condition has been exacerbated by the difficulties that go along with being on a low income. So whilst frontline mental health services are undoubtedly an important tool we need in order to combat mental illness, striving to challenge income equality could also have a huge effect on the mental health of our citizens. In this way, we can once again see the austerity that has put undue pressure and stress upon countless families, that has cut funding to frontline services, is adding to the problem, and the Westminster government aren't facing up to their realities or their responsibilities. The cut to the mental health budget has not just begun with austerity, however. Mental health charities and voluntary organisations do a fantastic job with extremely limited resources, and they often have to turn away needy people, particularly those that require residential care due to the lack of funding. The recent cuts to the budget of the Glasgow Association of Mental Health serves as a stark reminder that cuts do nothing but punish the most vulnerable, the sick and the needy. The Scottish Government have made a commitment to ensuring that mental health and wellbeing will be a focus of their healthcare policy. It has, however, come under recent criticism from psychiatrists and mental health professionals. In 2009, the SNP government invested around £7 million of government money into mental health research. Research that focused particularly on finding alternative therapies to ease the suffering of those with mental health problems. We're beginning to understand conditions like depression and dementia more fully, and the development of new drugs and therapies to treat these conditions is, according to health professionals, of the utmost importance. The Scottish Socialist Party has a policy that demands that people suffering from mental illness should have a full range of treatment options, from medication to counselling to diversional activities. But sadly, this has not yet become a reality, and the Scottish Government last year spent only £860,000 on mental health-related projects from a budget of over £69 million. Whilst the Scottish Government has acknowledged the need for mental health to be given equal priority to physical illness, and this is something we should all welcome, spending on mental health projects is at its lowest in 8 years. Dr. Alistair Cook, Chair of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, said while speaking to the Sunday Herald, "Psychiatric disorders tend not to attract the levels of charitable research funding the same as other health topics. Mental health is responsible for 23% of the disease burden in the UK, but receives only around 11% of health funding and less than 7% of research funding. Maybe this goes some way to explaining why levels of mental illness in Scotland are still higher than the European average. Perhaps this lack of funding lies in the fact that mental illness, despite some important strides to the contrary, still comes with a social stigma. What we need is education about mental illness. This should be in schools, in the workplace, at universities and colleges and everywhere in between. We need to approach people on their doorsteps where they feel comfortable. We need to let people know that they are not alone and that help is there, whether through their GP or local counsellors or a volunteer organisation. Not only may this help people affected by mental illness to speak out openly and frankly about their experiences, but it will enable individuals and their families and friends to spot the signs and seek help before the problem becomes unmanageable. And I know about stigma. So in the spirit of openness, I'm going to say something here that very few people know about me. I suffer from a mental illness. And I remember pre-diagnosis feeling as if my problems weren't worthy enough, that I wasn't sick enough. And I remember the embarrassment I felt confiding in my doctors and breaking down in the middle of a clinic. But I needn't have been worried. But whilst my consultants and GPs have done a fantastic job of getting me back on my feet, I'm all too aware of how someone can get lost in that system. We need to do everything we can to ensure we treat mental illness with the same urgency that we do physical illness. Because if we don't, we'll regret it. We'll regret seeing the lives of people destroyed and turned into a statistic.
These are The Wakes, and this is Empire of Skulls.
Cross the seas lie the colonies, blessed by gods but ruined by greed, and the pursuit of man to conquer land. This is an empire built on skulls. As a boy I learned the history of an empire where the sun never sets, but as a man I learned the misery, things that make this Britain great. This is the age of the empire. Black ships who rule the waves, foreign queens upon thrones of blood, and nations chained to her as slaves. To go the spoils,
The execution of Louis XVI of France on the 21st of January 1793 marked something closer to the middle of rather than the end of the beginning of the French Revolution. The revolution was no overnight phenomenon, but rather a lengthy process, you see, that played out over the course of nearly 10 years between 1789 and 1799, having been triggered by a series of events stretching back further even than that. I'm Callum Martin of Edinburgh South and Midlothian SSP, and today welcome to Making the Flag Red, looking at struggle and the movement for democracy through history. Today we're looking at the first part of the French Revolution, surely one of the most transformational events in European history, from the outbreak of the change itself to the establishment of the First Republic. But you see, the story begins in 1788. The Kingdom of France was effectively bankrupt. A series of major global wars, including the, some would say, decisive French intervention into the American War of Independence, had left the government facing crisis. With no welfare to cut, the king and his administration decided the only way forward was to substantially increase taxation on the people of France. Faced with the need to keep raising taxes, the king found himself having to summon the Estates Generales, the French Parliament, for the first time in several years. Now, the Estates Generales consisted at this stage of three parts, or estates: the nobility, the first estate, the Catholic hierarchy within France, the second estate, and the third estate, nominally representing sort of everyone else, the boroughs, the counties, but in effect it was a swathe of the population, primarily from the middle and especially upper middle classes. Now, the nobility of France, the first estate, enjoyed extreme privilege in this period. That, you know, huge palaces, hunting parties, really the works. On the streets of Paris, meanwhile, food shortages, poverty and hunger bit deep. And the same was true all across France. Now, when the Estates Generales came together, it was clear that the first and second estates entirely believed that they themselves should be more or less exempt from this increased tax burden. Instead, they believed it should fall on basically everyone below themselves. Now, eventually enough was enough. It was the summoning of the estates that brought them together, but the third estate, finding themselves basically ignored and about to face a huge increase in taxation with no marked increase in representation, declared they were forming a national assembly and began to reject the absolute nature royal authority was supposed to hold in France. You see, they represented the overwhelming authority of the monarchy to levy taxation and so forth without meaningful representation. The very principles the French king had supported in America now worked against him in France. With the king attempting to disperse the National Assembly, the situation rapidly began to slip out of his control. The National Assembly, you see, would not disband, and responded by growing increasingly radical, making declarations of universal human rights for French men, and looking to abolish the lingering remains of the feudal system in France. The Bastille prison at this stage was very famously stormed by the people of Paris, the Paris Commune, and a few weeks later we find what was known as the Women's March in Versailles, possibly one of the defining moments of the establishment of the First Republic. With bread increasingly scarce in the city, and prices skyrocketing, a group of women sparked a riot at the marketplace in Paris, rousing a huge number of increasingly well-armed people to march in the Palace of Versailles. With the palace under siege and help too far away to be of any use to him, the king was forced to yield. France became a constitutional monarchy. Now, the new constitution recognized the National Assembly, but in exchange it gave veto powers to the king. Initially it seemed there would be a moment of calm. People believed that this situation could work, especially figures like the Marquis de Lafayette, the great constitutional monarchist of the day. But the situation began to grow increasingly unstable, as the situation became clear that the king could not exert the authority he sought to, and the king began to attempt to flee Paris at this stage. At captured and being dragged back to his palace, the attempted flight of the king proved a major setback for the constitutional monarchists, as many became convinced the king would not cooperate but on his own terms. The situation broke down further when the king began to use his veto to try to break down the power of the assembly itself. Meanwhile, a group known as the Sans-Culottes, and even more radical compared to the Girondists, Jacobins, began to agitate both inside and outside the assembly. The Girondist faction, sort of moderate constitutionalists, had formed a government at this period, or something approximating that. But the Jacobins and the Sans-Culottes resented the way under Girondist management, so they perceived it to be, and under the regime of the constitutionalists. Many of the spoils of revolution, both in terms of redistribution of wealth and power, had been transferred from not from the king and the nobility to the people, but rather largely from the king and the nobility into the hands of a wealthy and upper middle class, while still preserving many of the privileges of the king and the nobility that the revolution had initially purported to be replacing. Now, with the economy collapsing, the monarchists blocking reform, and the Jacobins pushing for even greater reform than the royalists were already blocking, a constitutional crisis erupted. The year was 1792. The palace was stormed, the king was imprisoned, and the National Assembly moved to abolish the monarchy of France. Thus, in 1792, the first French Republic was established. By that Christmas, though, it was clear the balance of power remained unsteady even in the fledgling Republic. The king, locked in his prison, still harboured hopes of a restoration. The Jacobins and Saint-Cloud still saw a France where the people were impoverished and hunger was rife. The scene was set for the revolution to continue. We'll be picking up next week with the story of the First Republic itself and looking what lessons we can learn from this event, and also looking at the impact of the French Revolution in Scotland. Until then, I've been Callum Martin. Thanks for listening.
Remember, leave feedback on the SSP website, www.scottishsocialistparty.org, or on the podcast site, sspcampsy.podbean.com, or email me at neilwscott@hotmail.com. Speak to you soon.